With calls to defund and reform the police gaining momentum, what does community policing really look like?
It means sitting down with the community and actually having the community tell you how it wants to be policed.
By and large, residents do believe that the police are genuinely trying to change the relationship.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today in The Takeaway for Wednesday, June 10th, how the Camden, New Jersey police became a model for reform. Also on the show, how a movement gains momentum without a singular leader.
This movement is a version of Arab Spring, but an American and global spring. This is our Tiananmen Square with race at the center.
And you share your thoughts about filming police violence.
I believe it's the responsibility of the citizenry to hold all aspects of government accountable. The responsibility of anyone nearby to film the actions of the police.
Ramsey Orta, the man who filmed the police killing of Eric Garner in Staten Island, New York in 2014, was released from prison this month. Orta captured Garner's final moments for the world, making I Can't Breathe a rallying cry for the movement for Black lives. But Orta served 4 years in prison after pleading guilty in 2016 to possession of a weapon and criminal sale of a controlled substance. However, he says he believes police and correctional officers harassed and targeted him and his family precisely because he filmed and released the Eric Garner video. Here's Orta in an interview with Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman back in 2016.
Are you sorry you filmed the death of your friend Eric Garner? Are you sorry you put it out for the world to see?
No, I am sorry for not having a legal defense before I actually put the video out there. Other than that, I don't regret nothing.
Orta's release this month has coincided with another video that has reignited a movement for Black lives by 17-year-old Darnella Frazier, who filmed Officer Derek Chauvin killing George Floyd in Minneapolis. Floyd's killing and Frazier's video have once again set off a wave of racial justice uprisings. At the same time that civilians are exposing incidents of police brutality on camera more than ever before, many police officers are equipped with cameras of their own. But that doesn't mean they're helping. A 2019 study from George Mason University found that the use of body cameras alone was unlikely to have a significant effect on police accountability. But videos of police killings in all forms do seem to be making an impact, particularly in shaping public perceptions around law enforcement in the United States. Understanding the value and the toll of documenting police brutality is where we start today on The Takeaway. Polly Gamakam is a media activist and the U.S. Senior Program Coordinator at Witness, a nonprofit organization that uses video to protect human rights. Thanks for being with us, Polly.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And Arthur Silky Slim Reed is the founder of Stop the Killing, an anti-violence nonprofit based in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And members of his organization filmed and released the video of a police officer killing Alton Sterling in 2016. Arthur, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Arthur, let's start with you. Alton Sterling was killed in 2016 in Baton Rouge. That was the same summer that Philando Castile was killed in a suburb of St. Paul, Minnesota, which is the same metro area where George Floyd was killed. All three of these incidents were captured on video. Tell us, how did members of Stop the Killing end up filming Alton Sterling's killing?
We were gathering footage for a documentary called To Live and Die in America. And our normal routine would be to lurk and listen to police activity and film those particular incidents that we caught police in interacting with the community.
The officer, Arthur, who shot and killed Alton Sterling did leave the Baton Rouge Police Department, but was never charged with a crime. You witnessed the killing. Tell us how that connected or didn't connect for you.
Well, definitely. It was like we seen one thing, and the individuals that was tasked with charging him, the Attorney General, in the DA's office seen something different. And if you're really familiar with the case, the chief of police has said that that individual never should have worn a badge. He was given a badge because he came from a long family of law enforcement, but psychology and his mental state wasn't right. So it was definitely just a sad situation for us.
That officer was never charged with a crime, the officer that killed Alton Sterling. Officer Chauvin, however, has been charged and arrested for second-degree murder for the killing of George Floyd. Arthur, do you believe the impact of video has shifted police responses today?
I think that the impact of video has always played a major part in telling the truth, but not necessarily holding them accountable. Jurors and other individuals happen to see things through a different set of eyes based on what the law has been. And I think that the uprising behind George Floyd is focusing on changing that law, changing those laws that give them so much discretion on how they can use deadly force. So I think that this is the most important time to be out filming. This is the most important time to try to document everything that we're seeing in action with the police.
Palika, let's bring you in here because to Arthur's point that this is a critical time for people to be out filming interactions with police. What is it that people, civilians who are considering filming the police, need to know about their legal rights? Is it our right to film the police?
Yeah. First of all, Arthur, I love how you put that, that video can help expose the truth, but it doesn't necessarily bring about accountability, at least not on its own. So thank you for sharing that. Yeah, I think the first thing to know is are your rights. In the United States, you have a First Amendment constitutional right to record law enforcement in public spaces as long as you don't interfere. And this is even during COVID-19 and regardless of your immigration status. The right has also been upheld by a majority of federal appeals courts throughout the country. But that being said, you know, we know that what your rights are and how they play out in the real world are not always aligned. We know that, you know, protesters who are utilizing their right to film are sometimes retaliated against, sometimes arrested. They won't be arrested for filming the police, but they'll be arrested for something like interfering with law enforcement. And whether or not you're interfering with the police enforcement is totally at the discretion of the police officer in the moment and later up to a judge or jury. So that's why I always tell folks it's best to keep at least 6 feet of distance between you and the incident, or about a car's length away if you're outside and need help kind of gauging that. If the police officer does tell you to back up, it's best to comply with their orders. You can even film your feet as you're backing up and say out loud, "I'm complying with orders." So there's some sort of documented record that you complied. You know, this is super important right now as there's been so much violence against protesters and retaliation against people filming during protests. It's helpful to have a record that shows the truth. And if police do tell you to stop filming, you can assert your right to film if you feel comfortable doing so. But if you feel that it's going to escalate the situation, I think it's best to stop filming. You can still stand there, bear witness, take notes. You can also still film valuable information from a distance, like from across the street or a balcony or a rooftop. And, you know, we saw this with the protester, the 75-year-old protester in Buffalo who was pushed by the police officer. The person filmed from a little bit of a distance away, and he or she was also slightly elevated, standing on some stairs, and it gave us a great full view of the situation.
Palika, we're going to hear from Barry Friedman, who's someone who consulted with the Camden, New Jersey Police Department on their reform in just a few moments. I want to sort of pivot for a minute here to the use of body cameras, which is one of the reforms that started to catch on, particularly after the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson. And one of the issues, it's not just the community that's filming police. Police are now also filming the community. And there is a big debate now about whether this is it for surveillance purposes or for accountability purposes. So let me play you a clip from Barry Friedman to hear what he had to say about that.
I like to separate other policing technologies from body cameras because most of those other policing technologies that we think about, like facial recognition or license plate readers, are surveillance technologies. And the theory behind the fortune we as a country have spent on body cameras is that they would be an accountability mechanism for the police.
Palika, your thoughts. Are they an accountability mechanism?
I just don't think that body cameras are going to solve any of our problems. You know, if you think about it at a very basic level, body cameras are just another way for police to surveil us. You know, they point towards us, not at themselves. And like you said, there was a huge call for more body-worn cameras after Eric Garner and Michael Brown Jr. were killed in 2014. And advocacy groups and civil rights groups really outlined recommendations for how body cameras could be effective if implemented, you know, including developing camera policies in public with public input, committing to, you know, well-defined purposes for which cameras and footage may be used, and having clarity over policies for recording, retention, and access. And I think most importantly, they demanded to make footage available to the public.
Let me respond with this, because in as we know, the rules and regulations for body cameras are patchwork across the country. Police departments all have their own sort of, you know, make their own decisions on when they release, what they release, how long they keep the video for, et cetera. So there really isn't one sort of federal guideline, if you will, for body camera footage. I do want to bring up, however, the case of Amber Geiger, who was found guilty of the murder of Botham Jean. And body camera footage was important in that case. And I'm wondering, Arthur, if you were encouraged when you saw that.
Definitely, to see someone held accountable for the murder of an individual, especially after they tried to manipulate the situation, it was pleasing to us. But when you look at the amount of time and the leniency that was taken on the individual because it was an officer, it's always been our mindset that once you cross the line and break the law, then you're no longer an officer. You should receive the same type of sentence that a regular citizen receives.
Polika, we're also talking a little bit now, switching back to the community members who film police violence. I'm thinking about, particularly about the incident of George Floyd. We heard from Ramsey Orta at the top of the show, who filmed the killing of Eric Garner. What is the mental health impact on those who are filming not just police violence, but ultimately death?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question to consider. You know, like you said, Darnella Frazier, the 17-year-old who filmed George Floyd being killed, she's talked about how difficult being in the media spotlight has been right now. You know, there's been people harassing her, trolling her. And on top of that, she's a young Black woman dealing with the trauma of having watched a man die in front of her eyes. And so, you know, I think it's really important that people, not only people who are filming, but people who are viewing these incidents are, you know, taking time to take care of themselves. And I know the DART Center has really great resources on, you know, vicarious trauma, on taking breaks from looking at imagery like this. You know, a personal stance that I take is I don't share footage of police violence. I might describe it, I might link to an article about it, but I try not to actually share the actual footage. And I always ask myself, if, you know, why am I doing this? What's my intention? Is it performative? Is it to show that I care? Is it because I'm upset? Is it because I think others haven't seen it? And then I ask myself, is there a way that I can share the importance of this footage without sharing the visuals myself and adding to the re-traumatization that Black communities are feeling right now?
Polika Makkum is a media activist and the U.S. Senior Program Coordinator at Witness, and Arthur Silky Slim Reed is the founder of Stop the Killing, an anti-violence nonprofit based in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As protests against police brutality and widespread calls for the structural reform of American policing continue, many are now looking to Camden, New Jersey, as an example of police reform done right. Back in 2011, Camden was already considered one of the most dangerous cities in the country. By 2012, after budget cuts and layoffs of about half of the police department, the number of assaults involving firearms tripled, and the city reported a significant spike in homicides. Those numbers, combined with deep-rooted corruption, further tainted the department. The city's solution to all this was to disband the Camden Police Department, lay off all the officers, and start fresh. In 2013, the Camden County Police Department rose from the ashes. Former officers had to reapply for the positions they held within the old department, including Chief Scott Thompson. Chief Thompson's goal was to create a new police force that emphasized de-escalation and community engagement. So far, the Camden County Police Department seems to be moving in the right direction. According to data from the department, homicides dropped from 67 in 2012 to 25 in 2019. There's also been a 95% decrease in excessive force complaints since 2014. Barry Friedman, the faculty director of the Policing Project at NYU School of Law and the author of Unwarranted Policing Without Permission, was one of the people tasked with reforming the department. He joined us to discuss the changes that he helped implement.
We started the Policing Project about 5 to 6 years ago with this idea that is not heard of in policing very much, of front-end accountability, meaning that we would work with the police and the community on the front end to set clear rules for how policing would happen. And when the then chief and now co-chair of our advisory board, Scott Thompson, heard about this at a convening we had with law enforcement, he said, come to Camden. I'm just about to roll out body cameras, and I have been trying to figure out how to do this, and you're the answer. And so we came down, and we created an online survey, but we also did a couple of large community meetings, and we asked a series of questions about how people felt about the body cameras. We wrote a report to the CCPD about the use of the cameras. They then revised their policy in light of that input and moved forward. And he was extremely happy about the way that went in his community.
How has the body camera process gone for Camden? Would you consider them a success in that regard?
I think Camden was a stellar example of how to do this. And I think the community was extremely pleased. But in general, you know, I have to say that I'm disappointed in where we ended up with body cameras. And many people have ended up disappointed because even though they were conceived of as an accountability mechanism, they have been used in many places as yet another surveillance mechanism or a mechanism in which to obtain evidence for prosecution rather than as a tool for accountability. And we could talk about why that's not worked out, but it hasn't in many places.
I just want to talk a little bit also about the context of this moment, Barry. We are hearing calls in many of the protests to defund the police, and that often means reinvesting and reallocating dollars that are going to policing to going to other community needs. Was Camden's police department defunded, or were there reinvestments made and money reallocated from funding the police in the community to funding community events?
I think the problem, Tanzina, which is true everywhere, is that the police budget lives in its silo and then all the other things live in their silo. And I don't know exactly, but I'd be surprised if Camden was different in that regard. I take this call for defunding the police to be a statement about how we're addressing social problems in our communities. And the problem that we have is that we have take a sort of a one-size-fits-all approach, which is no matter what's going on, we seem to call armed individuals to address the problem. And lots of these problems, substance abuse, people without shelter, mental illness, even domestic violence, I could sort of keep going down a list, are not particularly apt to be solved with people who are armed and who are trained in using force and enforcing the law. And for what it's worth, that's actually not a point on which you'll get a lot of argument from police officers themselves. And so I think there is a deep need to look closely at how we are addressing these problems in society. And it is all wrapped up with how we're thinking about public safety and policing.
You mentioned tools of surveillance. We're looking at license plate readers. I did a ride along with a police officer in Camden a few years ago, and that was one of the technologies that they were touting as a success. They were able to pinpoint gunshots with surveillance cameras. So was that the vision, or was it less technology and more, quote unquote, community policing?
Camden did two things, which I think, you know, many departments that are progressive minded are doing. So first, the departments that can afford it are, you know, rushing toward technology. And that shouldn't be a shock. It's not true in our personal lives. I mean, technology just overcame us. And of course, you adopt the tools that it involves. Community policing, which is one of those phrases that can mean, you know, anything to anybody. It sort of exists in the eye of the beholder. I think there, Scott Thompson, the then chief, and the current chief actually is also great, Joe Wysocki, they really get it. And there are a few departments that get it, but too many that don't. If I could just take a word, what happened is that back after urban strife in the 1960s, where communities of color, particularly black communities, were rising up, the Kerner Commission found that there was a lot of alienation in those communities with the police and recommended community policing. And so we all jumped on that bandwagon. But as we rolled into the war on drugs, the idea of community policing as a holistic way of interacting with the community got shoved aside. And there were the quote-unquote community police who did the sort of nice meet and greets with the community. And then there were the quote-unquote real police who did policing. True community policing is holistic. It's not community policing. It's policing. It's the police and the community working together to co-produce public safety. And if you're going to do that, you have to take an entirely different attitude toward policing itself.
Okay, so Barry, then the question is, I think a lot of people see things that they think might be performative, right? They'll say, well, the police showed up with an ice cream truck. The police are dancing with us at our local, you know, baseball game. There's video of police doing all these fun and cool things. And people might say, well, is that really community policing? I mean, does it end with the ice cream truck or is there more?
First of all, you know, when I started this, I was maybe improperly disdainful of the ice cream truck or the athletic league. And I mea culpa, because people have to build personal relationships any way they can. And if it's ice cream or athletics or dancing, that's all to the good. The problem is that's not the policing part of it. The policing part of it means being responsive to the community. It means sitting down with the community and actually having the community tell you how it wants to be policed. And that is not something that many police departments are doing. It's just not in their DNA. And, you know, hats off to Camden in that regard. And I think that's the lesson that many of the chiefs that I know that are more successful, which is that they are able to understand that what co-producing public safety means is giving voice to the community to work together and solve problems. And by the way, not just with the police. If you're really going to solve problems in society, you have to be able to call in other social services and other city departments. So it's a holistic way of making communities and neighborhoods safe. And it's a lot of work.
What are the police doing internally? I mean, isn't this also an internal issue for police, given the rates of violence, particularly among Black Americans? Like, does revamping policing also have to include not just technology and the ice cream trucks facilitating growing personal connections and relationships with the community, but also internal reviews of, you know, what people would call systemic racism within police departments? What role does that play?
Well, I mean, I think it's all part of a really important package. And I just want to make a point, since you pointed to violence in communities, particularly in communities of color where we're working in Chicago, the way we see this, and we don't have, you know, all the results at this point, it's still early on, is, you know, police will tell you all the time that there are troubled neighborhoods and there is gun violence and there are homicides and nobody will help the police. Well, it can't be a shock why nobody will help the police. They don't trust the police because of many years of very aggressive policing that led to over-incarceration and a lot of other ills. And so the theory of doing this the right way is, if you have mutual respect on both sides, if the community and the police are working together, then you're going to get the help to fight violence. And so you can either make communities safe by all working together, or you can try to make communities safe by sending in aggressive policing and tactical squads. But it's that latter thing that has proven just not to work, though we keep doing it.
So that was going to be my next question. What we see, there are varying degrees of success in different police departments across the country. I'll read some numbers here from the Camden Police Department. They say, according to their data, that homicides went from 67 homicides in 2012 to 25 homicides in 2019. And the department says there's been a 95% decrease in excessive force complaints since 2014. Given those numbers, one would say this is a successful implementation. But Barry, you've been working on this type of policing reform for a couple years. What do you see that's not working?
I mean, what I see that's not working is this, is the refusal in some places to understand that the success to making communities safe is working with the community. And this fallback all too often to there's an uptick in violence. And so what we're going to do is we're going to send in jump out squads. We're going to start stopping and frisking people. We're going to think that we're going to use frequent use of traffic stops as a way to fight crime and violence. And we did a study of this with the Stanford Computational Policy Lab in Nashville and found no relationship whatsoever between those stops and fighting crime and violence. And so I think we have to let go of this notion that we're going to enforce ourselves to safety and start to say, what is safety and what does it mean to the community and how are we going to work with the community to get there? And that's, for example, what I think, you know, I hear coming out of the Minneapolis City Council, and I hope is the direction that they're looking. And we'd love to help.
Minneapolis City Council just announced for our listeners that they would be making changes to how the police department there is funded. We're also, you know, we've just been talking about Camden. Barry, how much appetite is there that you're seeing right now nationwide, given the moment that we're in, given the focus on police brutality, in particular against Black Americans and Black people? How much appetite do you think police departments have right now to change? Are they getting it?
There are 18,000 policing agencies, more or less, in the United States. Nobody has a count. I won't purport to know what 18,000 agencies think. And in addition, you know, I think we should be fair to the police in this way. Take any given department, there's a range of officers with a range of different views. There are officers that are diverse in many ways. They have different ways of thinking about things. The question, and you raise this, is what are we going to systemically and structurally do? And yes, we are hearing calls for this from a variety of places. I think people are listening. That's the hopeful side of me, though the less hopeful side of me worries that we've been here before and not made a lot of progress. But on the hopeful side, I think people are listening. The problem is that, you know, we is twofold. One is just culture. Like, you've done things for so long in a certain way, it's very hard to pivot and change. And the other is a more fundamental problem that I was alluding to earlier, that we haven't fit the job description to who the police are. We have a raft of social issues that we throw at them, and we train them to exercise force and law. So it should not surprise us that what we get in a lot of situations are force and law, or at the least, not solutions to the problems that, after all, frankly, it's unfair to ask the police to solve, but we've thrown at them, like mental illness and substance abuse.
Barry Friedman is the faculty director of the Policing Project at NYU School of Law and the author of Unwarranted: Policing Without Permission. Barry, thanks again for being with us.
Such a pleasure. Take care.
Naima Watson is the Associate Chancellor for Civic Engagement at Rutgers University in Camden and a longtime Camden resident. Naima, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tanzina.
What did you see? Was there an immediate change?
The most immediate change I saw was just this visible increased show of force on the streets of Camden. And what I mean by that is that there were officers everywhere, walking down the major thoroughfares in the city, in the neighborhoods. There was more equipment out, as you could say, in like areas like downtown Camden where the transportation center was at. Really kind thing to show people, you know, we're here, we're present. But it was unnerving at first to see so many officers, especially so many young white officers in the city, and that hadn't been the case in years prior. And so when the transition first occurred, myself along with other residents were really hesitant.
When it comes to community policing, what does that mean in Camden?
What it means the most is that officers are just personally engaged with the residents and community members now. So certainly prior to this switchover, there were officers that were deeply invested in the community, talking to leaders, talking to residents, but not as much as what you see it right now. So there has been a balance found between how many officers are on the street walking the beat and what they're doing and how they're engaging. So knocking on doors, introducing themselves to neighbors, hosting fun community events to say, hey, we're here not only to protect and serve, but we're here to get to know you. And the police can respond, sharing their emotions, their experiences, and what it's like to be a police officer. That's dramatically different. And those trust building exercises have been going on for quite some time. And so I think what you saw, you know, a couple of weeks ago at the protest was all of those relationships that had been built paid off.
Does the community, Naima, think that these gestures are genuine or do they feel performative?
I believe they're genuine, and I believe a lot of residents feel that way. So certainly you're not going to get the entire city feeling that the police are there for them and on their side personally. I think with the national history of systemic racism and challenges African Americans and Blacks have faced with policing, that's not going to leave us overnight. Even with community policing practices, there's still going to be that fear. But I do think, by and large, that residents of the city really feel like the police are trying. And this has been a 7-year effort. By and large, residents do believe that the police are genuinely trying to change the relationship.
So we've seen a decrease in homicides, at least according to the department. In 2012, there were 67 homicides. In 2019, there were 25, Naima. Can, in your opinion, is that attributable to having police reform, having more cops on the street, having better technology? What do you attribute that to?
I think it could be attributed to all of those things. You had mentioned the technology earlier. Again, a little bit unnerving when the technology was rolled out, to know that there's cameras everywhere, to know that you're, you know, being listened to by, you know, listening devices that were trying to pick up gunshots in the area. So it took a while to learn how those things were going to benefit the community and not be seen as a form of, you know, true surveillance on the day-to-day individual, what they were doing. So I do think that technology, coupled with, you know, having a full complement of officers, which we had not had in Camden prior to 2012, and these engagement efforts of getting to know people so that when crime happened, when violence happened, you can go back to that neighborhood. People don't feel as scared to talk to you about those incidents. They don't feel as worried that they have to maintain anonymity for fear of retribution. So I think all of those things in concert with each other is what has gotten us to this place. And so I think when people ask, you know, has community policing worked? I think absolutely. I think our data points don't lie. And it's great to see Camden being highlighted in this way for our policing, where, as you know, for decades we were highlighted for being the most dangerous city in America. This is a huge about face.
Naima, is there anything that you think still remains to be done as the Camden Police Department moves forward?
I do. I think that they have to continue with the efforts they've currently laid out. I think, you know, there has been corruption in the past in the police department before this transformation. So I think transparency in terms of the officers who are in the police department that have these behavioral issues in their background, community should know about them. They should be aware of them. But policing is not going to solve all of the issues in the city of Camden. Policing is only one strategy. And so we have to ensure that jobs come back to Camden, that economic investment is here in the city. We have to make sure that the schools maintain the right path forward by educating our young people in Camden. We have to make sure that health disparities are eliminated, because all of those things are going to be the things that drive crime. So, yes, you can decrease using community policing and technology, but that's only as good as the other efforts that surround the community to uplift it. And so as people are thinking about these strategies across the country, what does defunding the police mean? What does community policing mean for African Americans who have been systematically oppressed? That's one measure of how we change the country, and it's absolutely important, but we also have to look at all of these other measures that impact our lives on a daily basis.
Naima Watson is the Associate Chancellor for Civic Engagement at Rutgers. Naima, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Ask any American to identify a civil rights leader from the 1960s, and you'll get a list of familiar names, from Martin Luther King Jr. to Malcolm X. Today's movement for Black lives and social justice, however, doesn't have leaders that are as visible or as iconic as in the past. And many young activists say that's just the way they want it. As protests around the country continue to gain momentum and force change, they're doing so without necessarily having visible figureheads. To understand the role of leadership in this powerful moment and how it compares with past and recent social movements, I spoke to George Ciccarello Marr, a visiting scholar at the Decolonizing Humanities Project at the College of William & Mary, and also Peniel Joseph, a professor of public affairs and history at the University of Texas at Austin, and the author of The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. Peniel broke down what leadership of Black Lives Matter looks like today.
Black Lives Matter wanted to be a movement that didn't have representative leaders, but they were a movement that was filled with leaders, especially Black, queer, feminist leaders. So what they eschewed, following the advice of Ella Baker, who had been the founder of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, which led the student protests and sit-ins of the 1960s, was this idea that charismatic leadership was ineffective in the long run. So is the critique of Martin Luther King Jr., a critique of Malcolm X, it's a critique of this notion that you have this one very charismatic, usually Black male figure who is representative of the entire movement. And so when we think about Black Lives Matter, they've really cultivated and produced thousands of grassroots leaders since 2013, since 2014, when the hashtag becomes a social movement. And that hashtag is founded by three queer Black feminists, Elisa Garza, Opal Tometi, Patrice Kahn Cullors. And so when we think about the leaders, there are actual leaders, but we never had this one voice of the Black Lives Matter movement. We never had this one person who we all sort of equated with the BLM movement. I think what we're seeing now in the context of this, really this global social movement, we're absolutely seeing leaders in Los Angeles and in Austin, Texas, and New York City, in London, in Berlin. But these aren't necessarily leaders who are gonna become the faces of this movement. Although there have been some, Tamika Mallory, there's been some who've been really electrifying and have sort of had their social media viral moment. But I don't think that we're necessarily gonna see a replay of the 1960s where we all knew who Angela Davis, Kathleen Cleaver, Dr. King, Malcolm X were.
And Peniel, to that point, which is so critical, thank you for explaining the differences there and bringing it, the context of Ella Baker into this conversation. I wonder if the United States, being the country that it is, that it likes to have people that they recognize and people that they can connect with, is there a risk to a movement that doesn't have visible sort of brands who are leading the movement to the success of that movement? Or are these movements going to be successful with the structure that they've set up, which, as we mentioned, does not necessarily have a figurehead at the top?
Well, there is a risk because there's going to be some people who are associated with BLM, whether we're thinking about the activist DeRay McKesson or others, who've gotten criticism by people who are within the structure of the BLM for sort of taking credit for their accomplishments. So there absolutely is a risk. One of the things I've always suggested was that what BLM should do is have four or five or six representative spokespersons who would be Black women, who would be queer, who would be folks who have been sanctioned by the organization to actually be spokespersons with the full knowledge that they are not leaders, that the organization's not top down, but it would let potential donors, potential fundraisers, people who want to support the group, actually support the group more seamlessly than when you have this kind of leaderless structure where we still see these representative figures. When we think about the George Floyd funeral, we see Reverend Al Sharpton, we see people who we can sort of connect with the civil rights movement. We don't necessarily have a person, a singular person, or a group of people like that. And I think that that would be a good strategy that still wouldn't be falling into the charismatic leadership trap, but it gives people who are outside of movements an easy way to distinguish who's connected to the BLM and who's not.
As you mentioned, Peniel, this is a movement that is now essentially international. The Black Lives Matter movement, the protests in the name of George Floyd. I'd like to bring you in here, George. We're also in a moment, and we have been, I'd say at least for the past 2 years, where there are international protests happening for civil rights and social justice in countries around the world outside of the Black Lives Matter movement. And I'm thinking about Puerto Rico last summer, protests in Sudan that have had success in reaching some of the demands that the protesters have. George, when you look at those protests, what are some of the qualities that they share in terms of their success? Are there leaders that have been generating that success, or are these, again, similar to Black Lives Matter in terms of their structure?
I think what Peniel said is absolutely right on the money. And I think one of the lessons that many have learned in the U.S. and worldwide is that in many ways, the structure of leadership that did emerge in the 1960s and 70s also became a liability, both in terms of the way that the elevation of individual leaders eclipsed the grassroots work that was really the dynamic part of organizations like SNCC, but also that leaders were able to be targeted and able to be eliminated by the powers that be. And this became a huge liability. And so I think we're struggling to develop different forms of leadership. And this is a global struggle. It's a global struggle against racism and against the legacies of colonialism. This has been going on for many years in resonance with Black Lives Matter, in resonance with struggles like the No DAPL struggle, anti-colonial struggles over indigenous sovereignty and rights. You've seen struggles in South Africa. Of course, you saw just the other day the toppling of a statue of a slave trader in Bristol, England, in front of a jubilant crowd. And so this is a global, it is a worldwide movement. And the question will always emerge of how is it possible to elevate organic leadership that emerges from movements, that remains connected to those movements, and that doesn't lose touch with those movements. And yet we have this situation in which another difficulty is the fact that the world and the political system of the United States in particular tries to impose a certain kind of leadership onto these movements. It tries to elevate certain voices, whether they're elected officials or whether they're, again, Twitter celebrities, and tries to identify these as the spokespeople for movements that are much more organic.
And George, you know, to your point about visible leaders being targets, I'm thinking about many of the leaders or the people who were demonstrating in Ferguson, for example, who were protesting against the death of Michael Brown at the hands of a white police officer there. Some of those people died or were found dead in years, subsequent years. And I think about Eric Garner's daughter, Erica Garner, who died of a heart attack in her 20s. We know communities of color, particularly Black communities, suffer extreme stress, societal stress, and otherwise. Are those other also concerns about people taking on the role of leaders to their own physical and mental health danger?
Absolutely. And I think there's no way to look at the death of Erica Garner as any kind of natural phenomenon. She was an incredibly gifted leader who heroically stood up against elected officials who were trying to water down the legacy of Eric Garner. And these things, especially the targeting of leaders in Ferguson, is something that needs to be grappled with, and movements need to be developed that can defend those organic leaders that, you know, that are embedded within those movements. They need to be able to prevent them from being targeted and from being assassinated, of course. And it needs to be said that this is an incredibly important point in this moment, where we're seeing people being unleashed on the protests. We're seeing the encouragement of right-wing vigilante racist violence against these protests. A Klan leader drove a car into a crowd. A white supremacist shot into the crowd in Detroit. And these are things that we need to be incredibly careful about as we move forward, building on the energy of the movements in the streets today.
Peniel, I'd love for you to pick up on a point that George made, really about how many of these struggles internationally are connected, whether they are affirming Black lives, whether they are challenging colonialism, in the case of Puerto Rico, for example. As we see these uprisings continue, the demands that they're asking for are also showing a lot of similarities. We've heard a lot about defunding the police. Yesterday on the show, we focused on that. How is it that the demands are in line or very similar without having these sort of figureheads at the top? Where are the demands and the ideas, for example, to restructure policing coming from in these movements?
Well, these movements are really intimately linked in a continuation of post-World War II global movements for decolonization, anti-colonialism, and indigenous self-determination. So when we think about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X, they are these watershed figures in this contestation between the global North and global South since the Second World War. And that continues. And so when we think about this movement is a movement that is a version of Arab Spring, but an American and global spring. This is our Tiananmen Square with race at the center. It's a movement to defeat white supremacy, eradicate institutional racism, but it's also a movement against racial capitalism. And when we think about that term, that's just a term that means that globally, capitalism has always been based on the super exploitation of people of color, but especially black bodies because of racial slavery as the global engine to capitalism in the 17th, 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. So what people are struggling with in the United States in the context of neoliberalism, and all that word means is just the privatization, the militarization, the commodification of public spaces for the private gain of the 1% globally, people are suffering similar deficits and similar vulnerability, whether we're talking about food hunger and food justice, child nutrition, asbestos, lead, children with asthma, the over-incarceration, the criminalization of Black and Brown people and Indigenous people globally. So they're all getting together. And even though there aren't these global leaders in the same way that we saw in the 1960s and 1970s, there are leaders nationally and globally and locally who are sharing information across social media. They're sharing information across all these different media scapes. And now people are supercharged in a way that we really haven't seen since the 1960s. And we think about this moment in 1968, May Day 1968, we had global uprisings. We had uprisings in Asia, in Latin America, in the Caribbean, in Europe, in the United States. And they were uprising for the same issues. But those movements, unfortunately, were defeated. One of the things that we tell ourselves nationally is that the civil rights movement had a beginning, middle, and an end. It starts with Rosa Parks, then MLK, and Barack Obama, he freed us all. That's not true. And what we're seeing with these protests is that 52 years later, after 1968, we now have a generational opportunity to transform and reimagine not just American democracy, but the whole state of global civil society. Who's a citizen and who's not? Why do we treat immigrants as if they're garbage and not human beings? Why do we treat LGBTQ and indigenous people as if they're less than human? And can we transform that at the local level just through a people-powered democracy? And I think we're seeing extraordinary, extraordinary transformations right before our very eyes.
One of the things that came up when I was covering the Black Lives Matter, the emergence of the Black Lives Matter movement for the New York Times, particularly after Ferguson, was from a lot of folks, particularly white journalists, the questions were focused on, well, what is this actually going to accomplish, right? What are all of these protests going to accomplish? And I think, George, I'd love your thoughts here, because I never thought that I would see as many Americans, and white Americans in particular, calling out Black Lives Matter, affirming that phrase, and also looking for policy change. I mean, can we talk a little, to me, that's a big thing that happened, right, from 2014 till today. But how do these movements, George, actually affect policy change? And is it enough for people to sustain these types of protests without a visible leader to make those policy changes happen? Or do you need somebody to make that, to go to Congress, to make those changes happen? Do you have to engage leadership, more formal leadership, for example, in Congress to get to that point?
I think we have an incredible blind spot, in particular in the United States, when it comes to how social change happens. Because we repeat over and over and over again a sort of wishful thinking that all power moves through the ballot box and that slow, gradual changes are really the way to go. And yet we're constantly shown in the streets that actually real power lay with movements in the streets making demands that cannot be denied. Every time there's a mass rebellion, whether it's Los Angeles or, you know, I've written a lot about Oscar Grant in Oakland, there's a chorus of voices that say this is not the way to make change. And yet at the same exact time that they're saying that, change is happening. At the same time that they're saying that officers are being arrested who weren't going to be arrested without these mass protests. You know, there are several compilations out there just from this week about all of the things that have been won so far, including the beginnings of defunding, including moves toward dismantling the Minneapolis Police Department and others, including the arrest and firing of different officers in Philadelphia and elsewhere. An officer in Philadelphia who was, had decades of abuse under his belt. And so these changes are happening. I think that's the first thing to recognize. The next question then is how to make them permanent, how to make them sustainable. And that does not center, I don't think, on the halls of official public power and public policy, but it definitely calls those into the equation. And here we have the difficult paradox almost that, you know, that this kind of leadership, that the moving into the electoral arena and into the political arena is both necessary and sort of poisonous to movements. It saps their energy. Anything that gets passed and changed ultimately is a watered-down version of what's being demanded in the streets. And yet this is kind of the condemnation that these movements have to pass through, is that they need to push and force change into the institutional structure, even if that change will never be enough. And this is something that you see with local elected leaders, many of whom are betraying the movements today. But it's also something you see, for example, with political candidates like Bernie Sanders, who I think opened up a whole range of possibilities and inspired a lot of people, and yet ultimately did not fully reflect and would not fully reflect what's going on the ground today. But this is something that's going to be hashed out by the movements in the future. They're just in a particularly complicated situation right now because they're already locked in, for example, to Joe Biden as a presidential candidate, who is not the presidential candidate I think that many or any of those in the streets today would choose. And so what you've got actually is a movement that has a lot of avenues for change blocked. And so what we're going to see, I think, is that change is going to be concentrated on local level pressure and the keeping up of that pressure, for example, in Minneapolis, to make sure that, say, the dismantling of the police doesn't simply mean the county sheriff coming in to do all of the same dirty work that the police were doing before, but actually means the building of alternative structures that make the police unnecessary and obsolete.
Peniel, I'd like to close with you here. It's very difficult to make any predictions right now because every day feels like it's just, you know, a head spinning turn of events. But let's stick with the summer if we can. We are still in a global pandemic. We are witnessing sustained protests now for more than 2 weeks and schools out, if you will. What do you see as this movement? How do you expect this movement to develop, say, in the next couple of weeks?
Well, I think we're seeing it already. There's been calls for a major demonstration march on Washington in August 28th, which will be the 57th anniversary of the March on Washington for jobs and freedom. Ultimately, local people are organizing thousands of demonstrators in every city from Austin, Texas, to Oakland, California, to southern cities in between, the Midwest, the East Coast, and globally. So one of the things we've already seen is certain municipalities have said that they are going to redirect their allocations from criminal justice towards investments in communities of color. So we're seeing policy transformations on the ground. As well, we're seeing different corporations and different entrepreneurs and business leaders say that they want to invest in anti-racism and racial justice struggles. This is all good. It's not enough. From top to bottom, communities of color led by Black people are saying that they want to transform the way in which we think about conceptions of citizenship and democracy. And that absolutely starts at the local level, like George was saying. locally, people are going to push and pressure for the desegregation of neighborhoods, the desegregation of public schools, and also the reallocations of resources so that people can finally live with dignity and citizenship, all people. It starts with Black people, but it's for all people. So this is a struggle for universal rights through the particular prism of that Black Lives Matter movement. I think what we're going to see in the next several weeks is more protests, but also more concessions from local elected leaders, more involvement by white people who nationally, really by the millions, are beginning to get it and beginning to say they understand that there's a problem with institutional racism and white supremacy, and they want to be part of the solution instead of being part of the problem. This momentum is not going to let up. We're seeing both organizing and political mobilization, because those are two different things. The mobilization is bringing all these people together. The organizing is, what do you do in the wake of bringing those people together? And what's really heartening here and very hopeful is that we're seeing so many people come together and want concrete policy changes. They're not just coming together and criticizing or in an act of dissent. They actually want to reimagine the world. And we should be reimagining a different world as audaciously and as ambitiously as possible. There's no idea that should be thrown out, and there's nothing that is impossible, because what we're experiencing since May 25th in the aftermath of George Floyd's death is historically unprecedented for modern civil society globally. We have never, ever witnessed what we're experiencing now, and I expect us to see more of this, but I expect us to turn this into an actual social movement where we can leverage all this energy to finally achieve our country in the United States of America, but to achieve our global civil society with human rights for all people.
Peniel Joseph is a professor of public affairs and history at the University of Texas at Austin and the author of The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. And George Ciccarello Marr is a visiting scholar at the Decolonizing Humanities Project at the College of William and Mary. Peniel and George, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much
for
having me.
So that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. You can always find us on Facebook and leave a comment there, or you could follow us on Instagram. If you've got anything you want to tell us, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.